You're listening to the American edition of The Voice of Russia. I'm Rick Young in Washington. On the line from California, we have with us Michelle Hebert, and she's a pioneer in mind-body-spirit integration. She's also a fitness expert, a natural nutritionist, and a guide in spiritual transformation. Michelle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I also want to say you're also the author of a new book called The Tenth Door, and it's quite a chronicle of your journey. But first, let's talk about what you are basically what your specialty is, and that is yoga and how you use that to integrate into your life, but also to overcome some obstacles. Let's talk about what you practice, which is Raja Yoga.
Yes, actually, I practice Raja Yoga, and I'm a teacher of Raja Yoga, and I've been teaching for 37 years. And people often ask me, what is Raja Yoga? And actually, Raja Yoga is inclusive of all the yogas. And I think it would be good if we got back to the definition of yoga, or the translation, which is union. So yoga is really the union of our bodies, our minds, and our spirits, and how we relate to the outer world. So it has a lot to do with the thought of harmony, of wholeness, and there are practices that can help us achieve that. Raja Yoga includes the Hatha Yoga. Now, in the United States, Hatha Yoga is definitely the most popular, actually in Europe also. However, it's just a small part of the whole picture of what yoga is. And yoga also is very inclusive of the mind, our mental attitudes, as well as it's inclusive of the breath, the importance of different breathing practices to clear the mind, and also it includes meditation.
Now, a lot of us have the impression of yoga, and we think of people sitting, you know, very serenely, cross-legged, very quiet. Or is this more active yoga?
Well, Raja Yoga includes it all. It can include sitting quietly, focusing on the breath, clearing the mind, or it can also include the physical postures, the different positions people put their bodies in to open up the body and to create more flexibility, as well as a higher level of health for the internal organs as well. So it's inclusive of it all.
And yoga started in India, correct?
Right. Yoga comes from India, and it's considered to be about 5,000 years old. However, the posture work, which is so popular in the United States, can only be traced back about 600 to 800 years.
Only?
Yes. So that means for 4,500 years, yoga did not include the physical body. It was all about the mind. It was all about achieving the highest potential that we can, and really achieving a point where we are one with all. So it had a much wider goal than just physical health. And the physical came in about 600 to 800 years ago.
But the ultimate goal of practicing yoga is, as you just said, is to be one with all. And does that mean that we, especially Westerners, that we have to swear off the material world, that we have to shed ourselves of some of the emotions that come with being in the Western world?
Right. That's great. Absolutely not. The idea is, and one of the things that my teacher really stressed is he wanted balanced people. He wanted people who could be successful in the material world, as well as continue the practices within themselves to help them become more successful in everything that they do. So when we're clear and inspired and connected with our source, we have a whole different impression on the world around us. So things open up when we're in a state of balance. So a person in a state of balance has a completely different life experience than someone who's out of balance. And yoga helps us achieve that sense of balance.
So I can wear a suit and tie to work and take the metro, drive to work, lead a normal life, except that I have this other dimension in my life, right?
Exactly. So the teachings of yoga really are not just out of India.
Mm-hmm.
Every culture has similar practices. Every culture, every wisdom tradition has similar practices. And these practices actually lead us to higher states of awareness. So I don't want to say that yoga is a religion, but all of the great, I'll say wisdom traditions, all of the great wisdom traditions of the world have these practices and have very similar teachings to the teachings of yoga. They come out of different cultures and they're expressed in different ways. But there is one truth ultimately, and there are different ways to get to that truth.
So if you could sum it up, and I know it's tough to do, in a phrase or a word, how would you sum up yoga?
The definition of yoga, according to one of the fathers of yoga, Patanjali, is yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. So yoga, technically, I'll say that one more time, yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of the mind. So our minds are constantly going. You know that it's estimated that we think about 60,000 thoughts in a day, and 90% of those thoughts you thought yesterday. And that's psychology. That's Western psychology says that. 60,000 thoughts in a day, 90% of those thoughts we thought yesterday. So we are conditioned, and psychology tells us that by the time that we're 5 or 6 years old, our thought patterns and belief systems are pretty well set. And we tend to keep going over the same material over and over again in our minds. So one of the things we want to do as aware people is to realize that about ourselves and to start to expand our minds and bring in new creative fields of thinking.
Well, it sounds like we're all on like a permanent repeat cycle.
Well, it's close to that. You know, they did a study on creativity, creative thinking with some Fortune 500 companies, and what they found is this, that at the age of 4 years old, we are at our 96th percentile of creativity.
Wow.
By the time we're 8 years old, it drops down to 36%. Now, think about it. What happens between the age of 4 and 8? School. So we start to, society starts to mold us in how we think and look at life.
What we can't
also
do.
Right, and what we should be thinking. And then they go on, and it's not just school. It's also socialization. And a society has to do that in order to be able to sustain itself. So it's part of the process of becoming a human being, really, as we grow up. But what they found is that by the time we're 44 years old, we're operating at 2% of our creativity level. And that goes up slightly after retirement. So as we go through life, many of us become more rigid in our thinking, in the mm-hmm. way that we do things, in our patterns of our life, how willing we are to take risks. And so it's fascinating. And one of the things about yoga is it's also all about self-knowledge, learning about ourselves, finding out how we tick.
Now, again, you've been practicing this for 37 years, you said.
Yes, I have. I've been practicing and teaching for 37 years. My teacher threw me in after only 3 months, and he had me start teaching.
Now, your book is called The Tenth Door. What is The Tenth Door?
Well, the title of the book, The Tenth Door, and the subtitle is An Adventure Through the Jungles of Enlightenment. And in The Tenth Door, I named it that because there are 9 openings in the body. So there are 9 physical openings. We have our eyes, we have the ears, we have the mouth, we have the nose, and you can count the rest.
Right.
But there's a secret opening at the crown of the head known as the tenth door. And it's also called the crown chakra.
But there are also 7 chakras in the body, right?
There are 7 chakras. Okay. The crown chakra is considered to be the tenth door, and okay. it's called that because of the 9 openings in the body, and they consider it to be another opening at the crown. So I named it that. And then the adventure through the jungles of enlightenment, the jungles are the jungles of our minds, our belief systems and thought patterns that hold us back from really achieving our full potential, as we've been talking about. And but they're also the jungles of Central America, where I had trained with my teacher for 4 years in the jungles of El Salvador. And I trained for 4 years, and most of it was in solitude. So imagine a 28-year-old young woman fresh off the boat from Cleveland, no Spanish, no iPhone, no cell phone, no internet, sometimes electricity, in charge of 25 machete-carrying workers who would show up to work every morning. Was it risky? Yes. Was I following my heart? Yes. And here's what I learned. If we really are willing to take risks and follow our hearts, that life opens up to us in ways we can't even imagine. So I wrote the book to talk about my adventure, my first 7 years of yoga training, a very unique training, but also to talk about yoga. What is yoga? And through the book and through this adventure story, I bring out the teachings of yoga.
So in this book, we will find out not just your physical adventures with yoga, but also your spiritual adventures with yoga.
Yes.
Is there really a difference?
Between the physical and the spiritual?
Right.
Oh, yes.
Especially your journey.
Pardon me?
Especially your journey. Was there really a difference?
Yes, there's a difference.
Okay.
There is a difference between the physical and the spiritual?
Yeah.
Yes. sometimes, though, that's a good point, Rick, because sometimes you can, through the physical, learn more about yourself on other levels, definitely. So we can push ourselves physically, and the mind has to come into play in order to do that. We have to use our willpower to push ourselves physically. But, and here we're going to get a little technical, I think spirit is something besides that. Spirit really is not the physical, because when our bodies go, the spirit, I believe the spirit continues. So the spirit is something besides the body. And, very interesting, spirit comes from the same root as the word breath in most languages.
Right.
So spirit and breath. So a good part of the teachings of yoga and practices of yoga are around the breath. And that's one of the reasons, because the breath really, in our physical plane, is the closest thing to spirit. So by getting hold of the breath, we come closer to our essential nature.
One question before, we got a couple minutes before our break. Does the physical always have to be challenged for us to actually benefit spiritually?
No, I don't think so. However, I think the health of the physical body is very important, because if we're in a state of disease and unhealthy, it's very difficult for feelings of inspiration to come through, and for that sense of spiritual upliftment to move through. So, and our bodies are the vehicles for our spirit. So taking care of the vehicle is a paramount, extremely important for people on the spiritual path.
Okay, we've got to take a break, Michelle. We're talking with author Michelle Hebert. She's a mind-body-spirit integration expert, also the author of The Tenth Door. And Michelle, we'll talk about your journey in the jungles of South America and your spiritual journey there when we come back. You're listening to the American edition of The Voice of Russia. I'm Rick Young in Washington. Our guest today is mind-body-spirit integration author Michelle Hebert. The book is The Tenth Door. And Michelle, thanks for staying with us. And where can we get the book?
Well, the book is available on Amazon, and it's also available on my website, which is www.rajayogis.net.
RajaYogis.net. And when you you wrote in your book regarding your challenges that you faced going to South America, tell us, first of all, why you went and what you found there.
Well, I have to back up a little bit to my first yoga class. And when I arrived in San Francisco after leaving Cleveland, I sort of stumbled into a yoga center, which this was in the 70s, so there wasn't much yoga going on. In fact, in San Francisco, there were only two yoga centers, and this was one of them. It was the first yoga center in San Francisco. Now, today, there's a yoga center on every corner. This was a while ago. And I took one yoga class, and what I thought would be a posture class, and it turned out it was much more of a meditation class. People were sitting with their spines very straight, and I thought, well, okay, I'll go in there and do that too. And I found it to be very challenging, but also something happened to me during that class. When I came out of that class, I felt completely different. I was very light. I was happy. I was very joyful and inspired. And I knew that there was something there, but I didn't know what it was.
Well, how fast was that transformation for you, that change?
Well, I noticed a difference right after the class compared to where I was when I went into that class.
Mm-hmm.
And but then as I decided to continue and I did a trade, because I didn't have a lot of money at the time, to work in the restaurant, Walt Baptiste was the teacher, and he and his wife had a restaurant as well and a gym. He was a former Mr. America and a health food store. So it was really a complex. I started working in the restaurant, and I would say within a couple of weeks, I started to notice major differences. One of them was, which was totally unexpected, was my eyesight improved dramatically.
Interesting.
As well as my hearing. I could hear things. It was almost like Superman hearing.
Mm-hmm.
On one side of the restaurant with people speaking very softly, and I could hear their complete conversations. So that was one of the first things I noticed, besides that colors were brighter as well.
So your senses were heightened.
My senses were definitely heightened. And also, I was feeling much clearer and calmer than my normal energetic sort of bouncing off the wall self at the time. And I started to notice that just things were clear, and I was more relaxed in situations that I would not have been relaxed in previously. So those were the first signs, and things sort of escalated after that. Now, during my first 2 years there, which was in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
The Baptists bought a retreat center in El Salvador, and Walt's wife, Magaña, had been born in El Salvador. So they were attracted to Central America or South America, and they looked around for a while, and they bought this retreat. And they were sending students down there to help with the project because the jungles had to be cleared and the buildings had to start to go up. And I was, as soon as I heard that they bought this retreat, I was in a fever to get there. And I can't tell you why. I think it was my destiny. And
you were drawn to that place.
I was totally drawn. And I was the new girl at the center. So I was sort of the last person to go down, but when I did go down a year later, I was left there as the manager of the retreat. The person who was managing before, they did not renew his visa because he'd been in the country for 6 months and he had to leave the country. And so Walt Baptiste asked me if I would stay on as manager, and I was flabbergasted. But I did. And during that period of time, he kept me very busy. He would come every 3 months or so to check on the building and the workers and how I was doing with it all. And then he would go back to the United States. And each time, he gave me tests that I had to perform for the next 3 months. So I'll give you an example. The first time he left me alone, he gave me a piece of paper, and on the paper were 10 yoga poses, and he said to me, I want you to learn how to hold each pose for 1 hour.
Wow.
And I'll be back in 3 months. Now, one of the things Thoreau said in his book Walden was that when you're in solitude, it's very important to make a schedule for yourself or you'll go mad. And so I, at that time, I hadn't read Walden. I read it later and totally related. But I set a schedule for myself, and I started off with 3 minutes, and then I went up to 5 minutes. I had a timer. And in the end of 3 months, many of the poses, I was up to an hour, although certainly not all of them. And what I learned was this, that it wasn't the postures themselves that were difficult, because you can strengthen your body, you know, over time. But it was the mind having to stay in one position and deal with the mind and deal with the different things that come up within ourselves, how we have a new project and we're really enthusiastic and excited about it, and then after a little bit of time we say, oh, that's not so important, or I'll get to this later, and then what at one time was something that we were very enthusiastic about becomes sort of mediocre, not really that important. So, and so I watched these things in my mind and learned a lot about myself.
So the exercises weren't really about the posture. It wasn't really about the poses, if you will, that he wanted you to strike, but he wanted you to take the time to be with yourself. Is that it?
I would say that was a part of it. Now, one thing about the yoga poses, and I don't want to minimize them, is because they have effects on our spine, as well as the organs and the joints. But there are certain energies in the spine, which is taught in yoga, there are energies in the spine that are really considered to be probably, they say, the most powerful energy in the universe is in the spine. And the ancient yoga masters would learn how to activate that energy and use it for different purposes. So it can be used for healing the physical body. Once we open up the energies in the spine, the energy is free to flow to different areas of the body that is needed. So I would say it was twofold. One of them was to start activating some of these deeper energies, and the other was to get hold of the mind. The two together are very powerful in heightening our awareness.
Now,
so,
but you also call yourself a practical mystic.
I do, because I am a mystic. I do the most important practice that I do in my life is meditation, because it influences everything else that I do in my life. So there's a big difference on a day where I start off with meditation and the days where I sort of let it go. There's a big difference in how I view the world and how I interact with the world.
Well, let me ask you this. As a mystic and a person, have you had mystical experiences?
I've had many mystical experiences, and that's what kept me going for 4 years in El Salvador.
But were you outside in nature? Were you outside when these things happened?
You know, the mystical experiences happened inside. So inside, when you close your eyes and you move into a space of deep calm and stillness within, then truly that's when the mystical experiences occur.
Because you mentioned Thoreau and Walden, and to my understanding, he had a number of experiences outside in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And usually in silence.
Mm-hmm. Right. It would be silence. And nature definitely is very conducive to moving into higher states of consciousness, because nature has its own consciousness. I mean, sometimes I look at a mountain at this beautiful place, Rancho La Puerta in Mexico, and I look at this mountain at Mount Cuchima, and I swear I can see it breathing. This mountain, you feel this powerful presence. And because nature is in the present moment, when we are in the present moment in nature, it pulls us more and more into the present moment. So there's definitely a power that being in nature gives us. And I would love to have more mystical experiences outside. I guess part of it is what the definition of mystical what mystical is. For me, it's more of moving inward and what happens when I move inside myself. And I have a sense of union with my spirit. And there's sort of a divine thing that arises from within.
Well, but so many people would love to have that kind of serenity, that kind of peace. Does one have to go through a yoga or meditation program to get that kind of peace? Is that the start of it, or can they do it another way?
I think there are people all over the world, indigenous people as well, that have their ways of getting to that place. But the stillness is really a key. And there are many practices that lead us to deep relaxation. You know, lying on your back and doing certain breathing exercises to calm the body and become extremely relaxed. Meditation is something a little different than relaxation. Meditation is generally done with a straight spine. So you don't have to sit cross-legged. You can be sitting at your desk in a chair. And it doesn't have to be 20 minutes or a half hour. It can be 2 minutes where we close our eyes, we focus on our breathing, and perhaps we might want to add a word. And the words that I use are peace, harmony, well-being. Peace, harmony, well-being. And the repetition of your mental, your mind repeating those words and a calm breath through the nostrils for 2 minutes makes such a difference. It pulls us into the moment. And rather than being in a state of stress or having a zillion thoughts going through our minds, we calm ourselves throughout the day. So one trick that I try to do is every time I get in my car, before I turn on the key, 2 minutes. When I arrive at an appointment, before I go in, sit in my car, 2 minutes. And if you can get into the habit of doing that 4 or 5 times during the day, each time you're pulled back into the present moment, and
okay,
we're much more effective in our lives. Well, would you like me to direct a short 2-minute meditation for the listener?
Sure.
Okay.
Why not?
All right. So whatever you're doing, unless you're driving, so if you're
yes,
driving, you can intellectually listen, but please do not follow these directions. So otherwise, if you're at work or at home, if you can sit down for a moment, have the spine straight, be sitting in a chair, and your hands just gently resting on the thighs.
Okay.
And then bring your attention to your nostrils and find 2 streams of breath that you can breathe evenly and equally through both nostrils. So as you breathe in, 2 streams of breath flow up the nostril passageway. And as you breathe out, 2 streams of breath flow out into the room. Very simple. Breathing in and breathing out, long, slow breaths. Make the duration of the in-breath equal to the duration of the out-breath. And as you breathe in, mentally repeat the word peace. And as you breathe out, repeat the word harmony. So breathing into peace, riding the word in on the in-breath, and riding harmony out on the out-breath. Smooth streams of breath. Even streams of breath. Good. All right. Now take a nice breath in, expanding in the lungs. And with the out breath, think of letting go to be well, focused, and clear. Good. And then open your eyes. So I'm not sure if that was quite 2 minutes, but it gives you the general idea how really simple it is, but at the same time, it's very powerful.
That's great. It's that simple.
Well, it's that simple, yeah. I mean, to start off with 2 minutes with that simple practice, they've done a lot of research on the brain, and they have found that meditation and these kinds of concentration techniques where we really force our mind to focus and concentrate on something definitely moves us to a higher level of awareness. There's scientific connection between the two. So it's just taking advantage of the time. You know, a lot of people say to me, oh, I don't have time to meditate. Well, everybody has 2 minutes. So it's just a matter of us putting our mind to it and our willpower and determination. And, you know, I really encourage your listeners to try it for 1 week.
Okay.
And see what they notice.
Great. We're talking to Michelle Hebert. She's author of The Tenth Door. She's also a pioneer in mind-body-spirit integration. Michelle, we'll be right back. You're listening to the American edition of The Voice of Russia. I'm Rick Young in Washington. On the line from California, we have with us the author of The Tenth Door. That is Michelle. She is Michelle Hebert, and she is a pioneer in mind-body-spirit integration. And Michelle, one thing that fascinates me is that what you're talking about, this mind-body-spirit integration, it appears to be entering into mainstream medicine right now, where people are actually, and professionals are actually saying, you know, 85% of the diseases that affect Americans are preventable because most of them we bring on ourselves, right?
That's right. They're stress-related. And insurance companies like Aetna are doing incredible work with not just research but also bringing yoga into the workplace. So they actually brought yoga into the workplace, and 10% of their employees went through a yoga and stress management program. And what they found was that there was a tremendous shift in people missing work, back issues. It was very positive from the bottom line point as well. So, and they're doing more and more with that. It's interesting that you mentioned medicine. I started one of the first meditation-based stress management programs at the renowned Scripps Clinic here in La Jolla in 1996. So that was a while ago. And these are some breakthrough hospitals who saw early on the direction, not just the direction that things would be going, but also there are people that really understand the powerful healing benefits of this work. Now, today, to give you an example, last week I went to see a client in the ICU. Her family asked me to come in using the Tibetan bowls and the crystal bowls, using sound, which is something that I do to shift the energies in the body. And I was in the ICU unit working with her and working with the family in meditation. And it was so interesting because there was a room right next door to hers with a big glass window, and I looked over, and two of the nurses were in there watching and listening to what we were doing. So imagine 50 years ago bringing in a meditation teacher into the ICU. I don't think there would have been a lot of that.
But not allowed.
It seemed perfectly normal. The other thing that's interesting, there's another hospital here in Sharp, it's called Sharp Hospital in San Diego, and they did a 6-week course for their cancer patients on sound healing, using sound, using the Tibetan bowls and the different instruments. So there's a lot of research going on in how naturally, using these natural things, we can heal ourselves or help heal the physical body. So they're using, of course, you know, their breakthroughs in medicine, but also they're using some alternative methods as well. And I get a lot of referrals from doctors for people to come and learn how to meditate.
But as Americans, are we so wound up, so stressed out, that it's harder for us to basically be still, to basically be quiet, to basically not have any stimulus around us?
You know, that's very interesting. My editor was invited to a press conference given by the Dalai Lama in New York a few years ago. And she's very New York. I mean, by that, I mean she's really quick. She's very fast.
As they all are.
And yeah. And as opposed to California, right?
And we're laid back, yeah.
Yes. So the Dalai Lama opened it up to questions, and she shot up her hand, because she's a journalist too, and she shot up her hand and she said, "Why is it so hard for Americans to meditate?" And he said, he looked at her, and he I don't know if you've ever seen him, but he has this
yes.
twinkle in his eye, and he says to her, "Why do you think it's so hard for Americans to meditate? It's hard for everybody to meditate. It's hard for me to meditate, and I'm the Dalai Lama." So I thought that was a cute story. But I do think that technology and how we are being pulled in the realm of communication and instant feedback and people expecting instant responses pulls us out of ourselves. So what happens is we're much more in the outer. And it's true. Once we're out there all the time like that, it is more challenging to withdraw and to move inside ourselves. So that's where the 2 minutes can be very helpful, where we stop, take a moment to breathe, and then we begin to develop a new habit within ourselves.
Well,
so it's consistency of the practice that moves into a habit.
Well, let's go past the 2 minutes. Let's say someone becomes as proficient at this as you are. What kinds of experiences have you encountered when you've been in meditation maybe for hours at a time? What are you seeing? What are you feeling?
Well, you know, one of the things I've learned and which I teach is when you really have a deep experience within, that it's really best not to share that experience. And it's because of this. I'm sure you've heard that if you have a project going on, that it's better not to talk about it until it is actually happening.
Right.
You've heard that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, in a way, we're leaking out the energy. We're sending out the energy too early. So what we want to do is keep it, you know, building and building. And that's the same for people who are into deeper meditation. That when we do have these experiences, we really want to not send them out into the world verbally, but to keep them within ourselves. But I can tell you this. I have learned that there's a lot more going on than we know in the physical world. And we only find that by going within. And ultimately, in the teachings of yoga and all of the wisdom traditions, is that we are not just physical beings, we are actually in the deepest part of ourselves, beings of light. And when we move into meditation, ultimately we want to make contact with that light within ourselves, because that light is within everyone as well.
Now, you're also a natural nutritionist, and as you mentioned before, our body should be in the best shape possible. We should be as healthy as possible. Obviously, this is the kind of thing that one needs to be, or the best possible physical situation one should be in if they begin to meditate, right?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I'll tell you, some people come and they start to meditate and they have a terrible diet, or they're drawn to yoga, they have a terrible diet.
Right.
And in a natural way, people begin to gravitate more towards the foods that are going to support them. It's like the old negative habits just fall away. And so, for me, when I first came to yoga, I smoked. I had started smoking when I was 16, and I came to my first yoga class when I was 26, and I was a regular smoker. And I thought, oh, man, you know, when I went to work in that restaurant, I thought, my gosh, how am I going to get my fix? How am I going to smoke? And I thought that the people in the yogis in the restaurant would really sort of put me down. But, you know, they said, no, you can go out back and smoke. So nobody put it as a negative. But within a couple of months, I started to feel like, yeah, I think with all the breathing that I'm doing in yoga, I think, and also the fact that there was something else in control of me. You know, in yoga, we're trying to learn how to really get hold of ourselves. And there was this, you know, habit that I had that was in charge of me, and I didn't like that. So I joined a program to quit. I couldn't do it on my own, but it fell away from me after a few months. And I think that happens with diet too, that you begin to see and feel. You become more sensitive in your physical body when you're doing the posture work also. And then you know that certain things don't make you feel so good, and you start to move towards things that make you feel better.
So basically, then starting yoga, even though one might be a smoker, one might be overweight, one might be addicted to certain foods, the very experience may make you not want them any longer.
Exactly. Exactly. And I see a lot of people who come to my classes who, in a very natural way, begin to lose weight. They tighten up, but they also, that begins to fall away. And it's not so much because they're burning a lot of calories, because I don't give a killer, you know, full-on intense athletic class. I don't do that. But it's because there's an effect that goes on in the endocrine system as well. And a lot of eating is done, overeating is done out of stress. And as you begin a yoga practice and continue a yoga practice, the stress begins to fall away too, and it really does. What used to be a mountain, you know, our reactions to things become molehills. We don't have the same reactive kind of behavior as perhaps we did before.
Well, I get the impression from what I've read about you and the 10th door and what you're talking about now is that most of what we either experience visually or simply experience physically is more of an illusion. We tend to either accept the perceptions of others in what our reality should be or is, and yoga tends to either settle us down or settle our mind to the point where we see things as they really are.
Exactly. I couldn't have put it better, Rick. We begin to see life as it really is and not through the smokescreen of our conditioning. Remember we talked about those 60,000 thoughts in a day?
Right.
Those are our conditioned thoughts. And we begin to, those begin to fall away, especially some of the thoughts that we don't need. You know, there's a lot of thoughts that are weeds there. I mean, we have beautiful things in our mind, but we also, there are negative thoughts, let's face it. And those negative thoughts begin to fall away. And when I say fall away, we have to take some responsibility. We notice the thoughts, you know, we see them go by, and we want to try to change them. So we have the ability, when we see ourselves moving into a negative space, we have the ability to change the direction of that space and pull it in, pull ourselves into a space that really we want to be. And one of the ways is through the breathing. And the other way is through what in yoga we call mantra, but the words that we used was peace, harmony. And I add another word, peace, harmony, well-being. So those are the ways of beginning to shift that. And then we really do see life the way it is.
And also the way we would like it to be, right?
Well, that's good, because our thought is creative. Thought is creative. So what we are thinking, we are creating into our future. So in selecting positively charged words and thoughts, we're creating those rather than creating something of negativity or mediocrity. And it takes being vigilant and being self-aware. Where are we thinking right now? Where do we want to be thinking? You know, it is, I want to say, it is a full-time job, but it's totally worth it.
So basically, then, what I'm getting from what you're saying now is, I mean, true awareness of ourselves is simply being aware of what we're thinking, what we're saying, and what we're putting out there.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that we have control over, obviously.
And that we have control over. And once we begin to do that, and really, we actually begin to direct our lives. You know, I have a very short little, I don't want to call it a poem, but it's very, very brief. It's called The Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters that I'd love to read. It's by a woman named Portia Nelson, and it really sort of sums up part of what we're talking about. So chapter one, I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter two, I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. So I think that says sums it up very nicely.
And for anyone who's out for a walk right now.
Right. Try another street.
Right. Try another way. Try another avenue.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Again, the book is called The Tenth Door, and we're talking about, you mentioned early on the program about the, that is the point, is the highest chakra? Is that?
Right. It's the seventh chakra. The crown chakra is also referred to as the tenth door. And that's the title of my book.
But what occurs at that tenth door, or what either is released or comes in, or how does that work?
Well, you know, there are stories of the ancient, not so ancient, some recent yoga masters. I mean, when I'm talking about yoga master, I'm talking about somebody that's really mastered it.
Right.
You hear the legends about some of these people. And they actually are so in charge of themselves that they can select their moment of death. So they gather their disciples around them. And
that's
they
in
move
charge.
Into, pardon me?
That's in charge.
That's in charge. They gather their disciples around them, and they move into meditation, and at the appointed time, whatever time the master feels is his time, he leaves his body out of the crown of the head.
Mm.
So the tenth door is considered to be an avenue in which the spirit leaves the body. And I named it that because, not because the book is all about that, but there is a portion in the book where my teacher teaches us practices to help open up that crown chakra. And it occurred in a pyramid in Central America where he gathered his close students together and then gave us this special practice, which I talk about in the book. So the tenth door, the crown chakra, is said to be our connection with the divine. In Indian paintings, it's depicted as the thousand-petaled lotus opening at the crown of the head. They say 10,000 points of light. So there's that word light again. Enlightenment.
This is fascinating in the sense that I think a lot of people still don't think this way. And I have not read your book. I've read notes on your book, but I will be reading your book. Michelle, it's a fascinating discussion. I wish we had more time, and hopefully we can have you back another time to talk about more of this, because I think this is the kind of thing that we all need to hear in our cars or on our iPods or whatever. I've been talking with Michelle Hebert. She's the author of The Tenth Door. She's a pioneer in mind-body-spirit integration, a fitness expert, natural nutritionist, and a guide in spiritual transformation. Michelle, thanks for joining us here in the American edition of The Voice of Russia. Again, we'll talk to you again.
Great. Thank you, Rick. Can I repeat my website one more time?
You got it. Go ahead.
It's rajayogis.net, rajayogis.net. And you'll find CDs for meditation, which I've made to help you along your way.
Excellent. Again, Michelle, thanks again. We'll be talking to you very soon.
Thank you so much, Rick.